Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Biz Radio U, pushing knowledge further by spotlighting the best in business.
Hello and welcome, everybody. My name is Adam Wozniak. I'm joined here today by my good friend's co-host, Darren Parkinson, and Brenna.
Hi.
Glad to have you guys on.
How you doing?
Doing well, man. Doing well. You excited for the show?
Oh, yeah. I'm really pumped about this one.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be great. Mm-hmm. Brenna?
Very, very excited. Same. Always.
All right. Well, we're Biz Radio U. We're trying to push knowledge further by spotlighting the best in business. And today we have that just in mind. Mr. Michael Taylor, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. And how are you?
Doing great. Doing great now. Mr. Taylor. I'm going to call you Michael, Mr. Taylor.
Michael's fine.
All right, Michael. Now, I understand you're the Executive Vice President of Anchor Packaging, correct?
That is correct.
Now, how do you get to that point? I know that was kind of a big question, but I mean, how does someone get to that point in their life to where they can just the Executive Vice President? Like, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, and is it worth maybe talking a little bit about Anchor Packaging for a moment, since most of your listeners know who that is? Okay. And Anchor Packaging, unlike a lot of consumer companies, would not be known to most of your listeners. They actually use a lot of Anchor's products. They handle Anchor's products. And I would bet that at least 80% of your listeners have our products in their homes today, but they don't know the name.
Hmm.
So let's talk about that a little bit. Anchor Packaging is a large corporation that's wholly owned by the Anheuser-Busch family. There's a name that you probably do recognize.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. What Anchor Packaging does, number one, is it makes all of the Gladware sold anywhere in the world. So those clear food storage containers with the red lids and the blue lids that are probably in everybody's cupboard right now, you use them to carry your lunch in, you use them for putting leftovers in the refrigerator. We make all of those.
Oh, yeah. I've got a ton of those.
Yeah, most people do, and we appreciate it. Keep on piling them up. But the other thing we're known for is if you ever walk into a restaurant to take food out, let's say you go to Wendy's for a salad, or you go to Olive Garden, or Red Lobster, or any one of 100 restaurant chains, and you take out food, and you don't get it in that obnoxious white styrofoam clamshell, you get it in something actually nice looking, we're probably the ones that made that.
Hmm. I understand there was a change in that. Like, was it 2013, something around there, whenever that was like a big change from styrofoam to that?
Well, what happened around that time, you're partially correct, is a lot of municipalities in various parts of the country began to ban styrofoam. Mm-hmm. California was probably the first one to come out, quickly followed by Seattle. Now you've got Washington, D.C., Minneapolis. You've got some of that going on in New York City, although it's not finalized yet. And in general, the consumer, your average listener, does not think highly of styrofoam. You see it littered along the landscape. You see it floating in our rivers and streams. It's not really recyclable. The makers of it would try to tell you it was, but it's really not recyclable. So it goes into landfills, and it litters the
stays
streets.
There.
Yeah. Most of our containers are actually dishwasher safe, so you bring something home from your favorite restaurant, you eat the food out of it, and if you're frugal, if you're a student, if you're on a budget, you take that thing and you pop it in the dishwasher, you run it through the dishwasher or hand wash it, and it becomes your new food storage container.
Right. I've actually always wondered about that. What's the lifetime of those products? Is it the same as the one you just pick up at the store? Or
it's exactly the same. And it's funny you ask about the life cycle, because since we do so much of this, we've actually done some consumer studies, and the average container is kept by the consumer for about 6 months. And the only reason they dispose of it at that point is normally it's stained by spaghetti sauce or something similar to spaghetti sauce. And if you've ever put spaghetti sauce in Gladware or anything else, you usually see that red ring that tends to form around there that nothing's going to take out. So at that point, they pitch it and they go on. So that's a little bit about Anchor Packaging, just to kind of put things in scope as to what kind of company we're talking about. So very large corporation owned by a very prestigious family, servicing most of the major restaurant chains across the country, a lot of the supermarkets, convenience stores, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the company that I work for. As far as how did I get here, I would say it's been a very, very interesting journey. And if somehow you could go back in time and ask me when I was doing my undergraduate, you know, where do you see yourself X number of years from now, I might have given you 12 different answers. This would have been none of them. I wouldn't have seen this one coming.
Back then, what did you think you'd be doing?
Originally, I thought I was going to become a stockbroker because my father was a stockbroker. So you kind of look at your parents maybe and say, okay, that's maybe something I ought to do. And then I quickly figured out that wasn't it. And then I'm kind of a car guy, fell in love with cars and decided, okay, I'm going to be in the automobile industry. And actually did go to work for General Motors straight out of college. Did an internship with them while I was in college, worked for them for 12 years, and found out something very interesting, really, really important. And that is when the economy turns bad, people still eat and people still go to doctors, but they don't necessarily buy new cars.
Yeah.
So the automobile industry was very cyclical, and there was good times and then there was extremely bad times, and it would just cycle over and over every few years. From General Motors, I went to work for Sara Lee Corporation, and that was my first exposure to food, and that's where I learned the invaluable lesson of in good times, people eat, but in bad times, people eat too.
Right.
So if you're in the food business or you're in the healthcare business, you're pretty much recession-proof, no matter what happens. When we had the global economic meltdown, 2008-2009, the company that I'm working for now, Anchor Packaging, not only didn't we miss a beat, we actually grew in profitability in those years. The business shifted from the restaurant segment, because people weren't eating out as much, to the supermarket segment, they were eating at home, but that was just getting dollars from a different source.
Right, that's a logical switch there.
Yeah.
All bases covered, that's awesome.
Yeah. So like I said, very interesting journey. Made a lot of mistakes along the way. And by the way, I would encourage people to make mistakes. If you never make a mistake, it means you're not pushing yourself hard enough. It means you're not really stretching and going out there. You're playing it way too safe if you've never made a mistake. So make mistakes, not catastrophic ones, not ones that are going to end your life or end your career forever. But feel free to make mistakes and seek out companies that encourage their employees to make calculated mistakes.
And also, what are some of the tips you have for, because say sometimes you make mistakes, you're like, okay, this is a bad idea. Let's scrap that and try something new versus, okay, having a rough patch here. Let's keep pushing through. What are some of the things you look for in making that type of decision?
Okay, that's a great question. So that suggests that before you make that decision, it's always a good idea to think through and say, well, I think this is going to work, but in case it doesn't, what's my contingency plan? What am I going to do if this thing doesn't work? So a little bit of pre-planning. And that's actually happened with me. I went out and did something that I thought was great for the company I was with. Turned out that it didn't work out at all. But I had this contingency plan, and I could launch the contingency plan and take something that looked like it was going to be a dismal failure, and it actually became reasonably successful. So have a plan before you go in. Next is obviously learn from your mistakes. You actually learn very little from successes. Mm-hmm. It's great to have them. We all love them. But you don't learn a whole lot from them.
Yeah, the Atlanta Falcons, we know.
I don't want to talk about that.
Yeah, let's not. That was one ugly game. But yeah, mistakes are great. You learn a lot from your mistakes, and you can leverage them for the rest of your career. You can spot that kind of similar situation coming and avoid that pitfall. You can develop responses to it. You can develop plans for it. So mistakes are great as long as, like I said, they're not career-ending mistakes.
Okay, so I guess we covered where you can't. Well, when you set out to, I guess, start your career, where did you think that? What point did you think that this isn't what I want to do, and you made that shift?
Good question. So, like I said, kind of fell in love with the automobile industry. Went to work for General Motors. That's what I really thought I wanted to do. Every year when they would ask me at performance review time, you know, what are your career aspirations? Standard line was, I want to get as high up as I can in this organization. I want to be able to have as much of an impact on this organization as possible. That was kind of the standard line you gave. And after 12 years with them, I actually had worked my way up fairly high within the ranks of one of the car divisions. Oldsmobile, which unfortunately isn't around anymore, but I think most people still remember the Oldsmobile Cutlass, the 442. So it was a good brand when it was out. But I actually got high enough that you can start to see what's happening at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a long time ago, but what I saw wasn't very good at the time. What I saw was a company that was maximizing profits in the very, very short term and was sacrificing its future in order to do that. Mm. Tremendous cutbacks in new product development, trying to make all of the different brands, Chevrolet, Buick, Cadillac, Oldsmobile, all pretty much look the same. Use shared parts, no innovation. Everything was about cost cutting and maximizing profit in the short term. And when I saw that, it became very clear this company is headed for disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was with a company of, let's say, $1 billion or smaller, and if I was high enough, I might be arrogant enough to think, maybe I can help them. Maybe I can stop them from making this tragic mistake. But General Motors was a Goliath. There was no way that I was going to be able to impact anything. And so I made the decision, I don't see a future here. And that's when I shifted over to the food industry with Sara Lee. Great decision. I've stayed in things related to the food industry ever since. That just happens to be another passion of mine besides cars. I'm kind of a food guy. And it served me very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that must have been kind of difficult realizing, like, once you got up there and you kind of had your head above the clouds and you could see it, and you're just like, oh no, they're doing it.
Yeah.
I can't, like, why are they doing that?
Yeah.
In the short.
Well, I knew why they were doing it. And it's really something that's wrong, was wrong, and probably to some extent is still wrong with the way that we do things here in the United States in corporations. And that is the very highest level of people have stock options. Where they're tremendously incentivized personally to deliver very, very short-term dramatic financial results.
To meet that quarter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if the name Roger Smith means anything to any of you or any of your listeners. There certainly have been books written about the time when Roger Smith became the head of General Motors. He was an accountant.
Mm-hmm.
All the previous heads of General Motors had been either engineers or marketing people. This guy was an accountant. He was no dummy.
That's my people.
That's your people. Well, okay, so I apologize in advance for what I'm about to say.
It's okay.
But Roger Smith figured out very quickly that to make Roger Smith the most amount of money possible, what he needed to do was basically destroy the future of General Motors.
Oh, gosh.
Cut costs everywhere. Cut people. New product development's expensive, and it doesn't pay off for, at that time, the cycle time was 5 to 6 years. So you're going to make a huge investment now. And maybe profit from it 5 or 6 years from now.
Now, real quick, about what kind of time frame is this?
We're talking about the late 80s.
Late 80s.
And there have been books written about that time period and Roger Smith and even a movie made that's named Call Me Roger. But Roger was no dummy. And Roger knew if I kill these programs, if I cut investment, if I cut cost, it's going to benefit me tremendously right now personally.
Mm-hmm.
And he made the decision to take those steps to benefit financially right now. And whatever happened to GM would happen to GM.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I think that's a real reflection of the culture that is in a company. And it's really important to cultivate a culture where you have people that have integrity and aren't just working to profit themselves. So,
right.
What would you say you look for and like to see that in future employees?
Employers,
like for people like us that are going to be entering the workforce.
Yeah.
Like what are some things you can see ahead of
time? What are some of the qualities you look for to counteract some of those issues you see with some of the people you've worked with?
Okay. Well, I guess I'll comment from two standpoints. An employer standpoint, you know, what are you looking for to make sure that you don't find yourself in the same situation that I ultimately did, where I invested 12 years with a company only to see the Titanic about to hit an iceberg. And then what do I look for in employees? And they're not totally dissimilar. The employers, and my current employer is just a great example, very, very focused on the future and the long term.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's a week that goes by that the owner of our company doesn't get a call from some private equity firm that wants to offer a huge amount of money to buy Anchor Packaging. And the guy just laughs and turns it down. Now, it helps that he's a member of the Anheuser-Busch family and he can afford to laugh and turn it down. That doesn't hurt anything. But the reality is he's not looking for a quick buck. He's not looking to cash out and go retire on an island somewhere. He's in it for the long haul. He wants this to eventually pass to his son and all the way down the line. Can't always have that. I mean, there's publicly traded corporations, but certainly a company that's focused on the long term rather than maximizing short-term profits. That's probably the single biggest thing. A company that's focused on continually reinventing itself.
Right.
Andy Grove, who was the CEO of Intel Corporation a number of years ago, was very famous for saying, I believe in continually cannibalizing ourselves, because if we don't cannibalize ourselves, somebody else will.
Mm-hmm.
So even though you've just come out with a brand new product and it's selling great and you're very profitable, don't be afraid to kill that product if you can come out with something that's even better.
Mm-hmm. And that's prevalent. Very, very much in the computer and tech industry.
Sure. And it's true in other industries too. And the short-term mentality is, wait a minute, we just invested a lot of money. We just launched this product. It's doing great. We're finally reaping the profits from the investment we just made. We don't want to kill it. Let's run this thing for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the mentality of your company, eventually some competitor is going to bury you.
Yeah. You kind of leave yourself vulnerable if you're not, you know, constantly having an open mind to like the next thing.
Right. Right. So from an employee standpoint, if I'm looking at employees and I interview people who want to come in for a variety of reasons, variety of disciplines, one of the key things is somebody who really embraces change.
Mm-hmm.
I realize as human beings, we tend to resist change. We like to get into a comfort zone. We like to do what we've always done. It feels good. It feels safe. But if you're not embracing change, if you're not looking for change, you're not going to last. The times we're in right now, things are changing faster than they've ever changed before in the history of mankind. I mean, things are changing in 5 years, what it used to take 50 or 100 years to change several generations ago. So you really have got to be all about change.
Right. I completely agree.
So this isn't the only venture that you're invested in. Also, you're pretty versed with real estate as well.
Yeah, real estate's kind of a fun thing to play around with. And, you know, it's a little bit of quicksand. You've got to be careful what you do and how you do it. And again, go back to the global crisis of 2008, 2009. A lot of people did a lot of silly things then and did not turn out well for them. But if you're a good, disciplined value investor, if you do your research, if you understand what you're doing, if you don't leverage yourself too far out, then real estate can be a great long-term profit builder and also a short-term source of cash flow. So I do enjoy playing with real estate.
And where did you get started with that?
I mean, I bought my first house when I was 20 years old. It was a cheap house. I fixed it up, sold it about a year later for a pretty good profit. Did that with the next several houses. So kind of got an appetite for it from there. And then just over time, as opportunities have presented themselves, I've chosen to invest, whether it's a piece of property that I'm going to keep and flip later, or something that I'm going to turn into a rental property and have a cash stream from. It's something that I've always had an interest in.
That's cool. And do you have other people that work with you on this, or is it something you keep to yourself?
Oh, my daughter works with me quite a bit on the real estate end. She manages one of the rental properties right now.
Mm-hmm.
So she's getting some exposure to it. And my hope is that someday when she finishes college, moves into her career, maybe it's something that she chooses to do in addition to build long-term wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your experience been like with that, Amanda?
It's been pretty good. It's a good thing to do. It gives me a lot of experience, and I think it's really helped maturity because you're having to deal with people from different walks of life and what's going to make a good rental candidate. You don't want somebody who's going to move in and skip out on rent and be like, see ya. So that's been a bit of a process, and just figuring out who's going to be a good fit and who's going to be a horrible, horrible fit. And my sister actually does the same thing up in Michigan with two of our rental properties. She rents out whole houses instead of subsidizing the different rooms. So she has that even to a higher extent, because that's more of a long-term thing where down in Georgia, we're more in the college area. So it's more semester rentals or two semesters, and then you're finding somebody else.
So an interesting sort of tenants, right?
Yeah, we've had a few.
You probably have a few interesting war stories.
Oh, do you really want to hear this? There's a mountain list. There was the roommate who was always talking about killing people and where to hide the bodies. There was the renter who, her brother ended up killing himself. And instead of being mad or upset that he killed himself, she was mad that he messed up his haircut that she had given him a week prior. I mean, I've had some characters. I had one roommate who had a mental health break and moved to California on a day's notice.
Wow.
That's rough.
So I guess, yeah, embracing change is what you were saying earlier. Being adaptable. Yeah.
Be adaptable. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah, something else that I wanted to touch on is, and this is an amazing feat, might I add, is you have not one, not two, but three master's degrees.
Yeah, I stayed in school way too long, unfortunately. did not do them all at the same time, obviously. Didn't set out with a plan to do three master's degrees. And by the way, I would encourage people not to go directly from an undergraduate degree into a master's program, with rare exceptions. There are a few fields where you kind of have to do that. Psychology being one of them. But for the most part, get your undergraduate degree, get out and get some real work experience under your belt for two reasons. Number one, it's going to help you really crystallize what you want to do so you don't waste your time doing a master's program in something that ultimately you decide you're not interested in. The other is I found that when I went back and did my first master's program after being out in the workforce for about 7 years, I had a much better frame of reference, and the things that they were teaching me had a lot more meaning because I could relate them to real life situations as opposed to it all being theoretical or something in a book. So I knew I wanted to do an MBA at some point, started out doing an MBA with a major in marketing. And while I was in school, you always have to take some elective type classes. Most of mine were finance because, as a marketing person, I wanted to really be able to understand the financial implications of decisions I might make. So all of my electives were finance. And then getting close to graduation, I found out, you know, if I stayed on for another semester and took like four more finance classes, I could get a separate master's in finance.
Mm-hmm.
So that made sense. So I did a separate master's in finance.
Bang for your buck there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was always interesting when I would, you know, be talking to a new company and they'd say, okay, I see you've got an MBA from Michigan, great school, you know, nice that you have marketing, but I see you also have finance. And what I would explain, look, I want to be making new product development decisions for you, marketing decisions, but I also want to be able to understand the financial impact. That kind of resonated with a lot of companies that I was being responsible fiscally as well. Mm-hmm. So as far as I was concerned, I was done with school at that point. And then they invented this thing called the internet. Have you heard about that? Yeah.
threw a little wrench in everything, right?
Definitely threw a wrench in everything. Talk about a disruptive technology. So this was in like 2001 that I realized, okay, this internet thing is really going to be big. Now, that sounds simplistic today in 2017, but back in 2001...
Yeah, nobody really knew.
Nobody knew. Most people did not email back in those days. There weren't very many websites, if any. And in fact, it was only about a year earlier that the internet had been approved for commercial transactions. I think most of you know the internet was developed by the U.S. government. It was originally done as a military type thing. Mm-hmm. And then as things evolved, they finally allowed commercial activity on there. But initially, commercial activity wasn't allowed. So back in 2001, it was like, okay, this thing is going to be real. I can see this going somewhere. Don't know where. And did some research, and there were exactly two schools in the country that offered a master's program in e-commerce. And believe it or not, Georgia State University was one of them. Very forward-thinking. They had some great people there. So I did a master's program there in e-commerce. They actually made me go through all of the computer programming side of it. I had to take C++, and I was not a programmer. I was not a tech guy. I had to learn C++, Java, all these different languages just to get to what I wanted to get to. But when I did, I was glad I did because then you get out in the working world again.
And what was this experience like learning those programming languages later on in life? Because I was a computer science major when I started, and I had very little experience with them. And it was challenging at that age because I feel like everyone else in my classes and within that degree, they had been doing it from like yay high. And it's tough to compete with people that live and breathe that. And it takes a certain type of person to do that. So how was that?
Yeah, good point. And it was extremely difficult. I really had to get my brain wrapped around it and spent a lot of late nights puzzling over the C++ editor as to why my program was blowing up and what I was doing wrong, and was not a happy time for me. But I made it through. Fortunately, I think I got a C, but I made it through.
Yeah.
And then I got to go on and do what I really wanted to do, which was get into the actual user-facing portions of e-commerce. And that served me very well. And that was a talent or a discipline that really was not even considered back then. People weren't thinking of that, like, hey, you can actually go off and get an education in this thing.
What was e-commerce like back in the early days? Because the only thing I can think of was, I remember back when Amazon really first started, and it was like, I was trying to buy stuff online, and it was just, that was like a no-no. Like, you don't do that.
Right.
Because there were, you know, way more fake websites. They were just trying to get credit card information.
Right.
So I don't know, maybe I was like 10 or 11. I was trying to buy like some Pokemon cards or some junk. Yeah, like
thanks.
That.
Make me feel good about that. You were 10 or 11. Nice.
But it was like, that was just my view of e-commerce.
Yeah, you're
like,
right.
They were mostly sketchy.
Yeah.
And you didn't want to give you didn't want to do online. Like, you were more likely to do like an LL Bean catalog.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
No, you're right. There was a lot of what we called brochureware out there. Mm-hmm. In other words, companies putting up a website with a lot of product information, but you couldn't actually buy over the web. But it was brochureware. And at that point, the belief was allow your consumer to shop and decide what they want to buy 24/7 at their convenience, not just when the store is open. Mm-hmm. And then once they decide what they want, then during normal work hours, they'll come into the store and they'll buy it. So there was a value there.
Yeah, like a half step.
Yeah, you had this salesman, if you will, that was 24/7, 365, showing your products, all the descriptions, all the pictures. Really wasn't costing you anything other than the cost to develop it. And it was like a big advertising site for you. At that point, Amazon was only selling books. That was the only thing they sold. And they didn't have a whole lot of them. I think Bezos had a relationship with one major distributor at that time. And of course, nobody believed Amazon would ever succeed. Nobody saw that going anywhere.
Speaking of startups, there was a little startup that offered you a position called Google. Do you regret not taking when they offered it twice?
Yeah, I mean, with the benefit of perfect hindsight, there's a lot of things I would have done different. I would have, bought stocks right before they went up. I would have done a lot of things. But
what time did this happen?
This was in about, I'm going to say, 2001.
Okay.
And I was coming out of that program at Georgia State. And so I was a little bit unique in that I had the classical marketing background. I had been with General Motors. I had been with other large companies. I had the classical MBA from a top 10 business school. I had all that. But then I also had this master's in e-commerce, which nobody had. You know, it was a brand new type of thing. And so when I put it up on the job boards, and there was one called Monster at the time. I don't think Monster is around anymore. I think it's changed names. But put that up at Monster, and all the lights lit up. I was contacted by everybody from Ford, Dow Chemical, Kodak, everybody, plus every startup that thought they had an idea. I can't even tell you how many startups. So I get a call one day from this recruiter, and he's telling me, hey, I've got this little startup company. Didn't tell me the name initially, not that it would have mattered at that time. The name didn't mean anything, but I've got this little startup company. We'd like you to be the vice president of marketing for it. Read your background. You have this unique combination of online and offline. But you'll have to move to California and the job doesn't pay much, but we're going to give you lots of stock options. Well, even then, I'd been around long enough to know that stock options were, pretty flaky. That's what all the startups dealt in. They could afford to issue as many stock options as they want. Odds of the options ever being worth anything was pretty small.
Especially in the dot-com era with all that going on.
Yeah. I mean, everybody had an idea for a business plan. Everybody had an idea of what they could do with the internet. and sorting through them was really difficult. Meanwhile, I've got what I would call, you know, real legitimate companies like Ford Motor Company calling me up and saying, hey, we've got a position for you. So I tell this recruiter, hey, appreciate the phone call, not moving to California, especially not moving to California to take a pay cut. Have a nice day.
Right.
So I go about my work and I'm responding to these other companies. And about a week later, same guy calls me back. You know, we've looked all over and can't really find anybody that's got that blend of the 2 degrees and the experience that you do. They really, really want you. I said, well, do I still have to move to California? Yeah. Am I still looking at a pay cut? Yeah. Read my lips. No, not interested. And, you know, she's already given away the punchline. The name of that company today, of course, everybody would recognize as Google. Mm. And those stock options, you can imagine what those would be worth.
I don't know. That's a lot of digits.
Yeah, it's a lot of digits. So I took the safe route, ultimately ended up accepting a position with a joint venture of Dow Chemical, DuPont, Bayer, BASF. Now, if you know anything about the chemical industry, every one of those names is you know, a giant in their mm-hmm. field. And they had formed a joint venture and they had put in several $100 million. And this was going to be their e-commerce site that they were going to share. So what could be safer than that? 2 years later, they closed the doors.
Wow.
So I didn't take the risk of the startup, didn't take the Google, but I took the sure thing with Dow, DuPont. This is what I mean by learn from your mistakes, right? Not the end of the world, but learn from your mistakes.
Like, well, but how could you have known?
Well, you couldn't. That's the point.
Like this.
That's the point. You make your best educated decision based mm-hmm. on all the facts, you know, and they were working with Accenture, if you know that name, top consulting firm. So, you know, everything looked very solid, very sound, very long-term. 2 years later, closed the doors.
Well, I mean, that's tech bubble for you.
Yes, it is.
Now, one thing we do like to hit on is entrepreneurship. And mm-hmm. I guess you would be more familiar with entrepreneurship. Is there anything that immediately comes to mind with that word? Like any personal experience with entrepreneurship?
Well, I really, you know, could give you some experience with both. Entrepreneurship, I would define as basically demonstrating entrepreneurship within a mm-hmm. company. So I have started up brand new businesses within a company, started up brand new business units, product lines, things like that. Have also done the entrepreneurship, started up a small company that did very well, ultimately sold it off to my partner. Mm-hmm. So I've done a little bit in both of those areas.
Yeah, is there any, what would you say would be the core values or, personal strengths that would make that, being an entrepreneur, like being a successful entrepreneur?
Okay, good question. I think you really have to be willing to question your own ideas. In other words, you know, any one of us can have 100 ideas a day. You got to be willing to really question them, pressure test them, and say, does this idea really make sense, or is it just something that I think is really cool? Don't be afraid to go off and do research. Don't be afraid to ask trusted advisors. I'm not saying, you know, ask the average person, but if you've got a trusted advisor, a mentor, somebody you respect, get that person's perspective on it. Mm-hmm. Figure out a way that you can test your idea with a low amount of risk. You know, do I really have to throw everything I have into the pot, or could I do a test somewhere, see how it goes, probably learn from that test, and then if I decide to go forward, fine-tune that idea based on the results of the test. Mm-hmm. So those are some things that I would suggest. And then you've got to have a certain element of risk-taking, as I mentioned. If you're all about never making a mistake, all about playing it safe, those things probably are not for you.
Right. You know, and I was thinking about you think about business ideas and that sort of thing. Like, you know, everyone has an idea, right? Like, we've come to that. And I was thinking about when you get that idea going in your head and you're working on it, and then you start getting excited. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh yeah, this might be it. Like, this is something to look forward to. This is something I'm going to wake up early and start working on, and it's going to be like that. And then you kind of think like, oh, you get that one little idea, a little subsection or something. You're like, oh, well, that's a wall. You know? And one thing I know I don't necessarily like struggle with is I haven't started a business, but you know, in thinking about it, you think of that wall, you're like, oh no, that's an obstacle. like, how would I ever get through that to make this even worth my time? You know, like, how do you know or maybe or
determine?
Yeah, how do you determine whether to just try and just break through that wall? Just like, yeah, whatever. It's going to be there. I'm going to have to deal with it.
Yeah, yeah, that's usually not the best strategy. Right. Kudos for recognizing that there's a wall. I think that's great that you looked at it and said there's a wall there. Much better to try to find creative solutions around the wall or over the wall rather than beating your head against it trying to go through it.
Right.
And there's almost always a solution, a creative solution. May not be apparent at first, but there almost always is one. It may be a matter of forming a partnership with some other complementary company. It may be, I don't know what, because I don't have a specific example, but I think it's great that you can sit back and recognize that wall as opposed to just becoming so enamored with the idea that you say, hey, this is going to work. I'm going to be the next billionaire.
You got to be open to change.
Got to be open to change, right? And you got to be open to rethinking what you're doing and saying, okay, well, maybe that was not the best path to go down, but I don't have to throw away everything I've done. I can just shift gears a little bit, go down a slightly different path, and it's going to be the path to success.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, once you get to that point, you realize, like, yeah, I need to pivot or something like that.
Yep.
You know, you just take what existing value remains.
Correct.
That you leave at that, like you, that you take with you from the wall, and then maybe start something different. It might be something like, it might be like just a new way to thinking or something like that. You can keep with you for
exactly.
All right. Well, we thank you so much for staying on. And I guess Darren, you want to ask the final question?
Yeah, I guess our final question to wrap things up. If there's one thing that you know now that you wish you knew when you're starting out, what would that be? We've covered a few things, but
yeah.
There's really that one thing you can go back and give yourself that advice. Obviously, the Google thing, you know, you can like get a time machine, but just...
Yeah. I guess it would be to, you know, especially when you're starting out and you're very young, if you don't have financial backing or financial security of any kind, as I didn't, came from a very, very poor background, didn't have a father, none of that, because he died when I was 15. He had been a stockbroker, but passed away of a heart attack when he was 15. So when you're in that situation and literally you're wondering where your next meal's going to come from, you don't have the confidence to step out as far as you perhaps could if you knew that somebody had your back. So if I had the benefit of going back in time with what I know now, it would be to say, take a little bit more risk early on and you're going to do fine. And don't be quite as conservative. But that's a hard thing to say to a 15-year-old or 18-year-old kid that truly doesn't know if he's going to have food to eat tomorrow. It's hard to say, take that risk. Trust me, it'll be there, you know?
Yeah, wise words. Wise words.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. And if there's any way our listeners want to reach out to you or maybe learn a little bit more about you, is there a way to do it?
Well, probably best for them to contact me through the show. Mm-hmm. And Darren can then funnel any questions. And there may be questions that come through that may be great to answer on the air if it's, you know, a really great, insightful question that might have broad appeal. So that might provide some material for a follow-up show at some point.
That would be great.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, we'll get that out on Twitter and the Facebooks and the Instagrams.
Yes, yes, we will.
All that. All right, guys. Well, I'm Adam Wozniak.
I'm Darren Parkinson.
I'm Brenna Phelps.
We are Biz Radio U, pushing knowledge further by spotlighting the best in business.